biggest thing is getting people to actually have conversations with the agent, to tell them the things that they are thinking, the stuff that is in their head. And, you know, we have to do that a couple of different ways. One, first and foremost, is asking questions. And so you sort of give us this idea of what it is you're trying to build. The agent is going to think through that idea, look at your code, and then come up with sets of questions to say, like, hey, you gave me, like, you didn't quite fill out a lot of information, or it's missing a lot of details. Let me try to extract more out of your head so I can then get that into a well-written, you know, requirement.
Welcome to the AI Advantage, where modern leaders decode the future of tech. I'm Solomon Williams, founder of Solonox. So here, it's no noise, no hype every week. Sometimes it's just me, and sometimes it's the brightest minds in tech, breaking down what it really takes to grow smarter with AI and automation. Let's dive in.
Welcome to AI Advantage. I'm your host, Solomon Williams. We have a special guest today. We have Tyler Wells. He is the co-founder and CTO of BrainGrid. So Tyler, thank you so much for coming on to the show today. Just for the folks that don't know really much about, just give us a little bit about like who you are, then what is BrainGrid for?
Yeah, absolutely. So I'm, like you said, Tyler Wells, CTO, co-founder of BrainGrid.ai. Been in this business now for 25 plus years. My background going back a number of decades, been in a lot of startups, been in bigger companies, did a lot of time at Skype, sort of the last big company I was at before going back out on my own. I was at Twilio for 7.5 years. And BrainGrid is, we started that company probably back in, back in February of last year, really going hard into agentic development, sort of at the early days as people were still finding out about Cursor and kind of the early implementations of their agents. People were still very much getting used to the autocomplete, but we found that autocomplete obviously was not going to cut it, and we wanted to get more and really dove in heavily to agentic development. And what BrainGrid ended up being at that time was the kind of missing planning layer of everything that you should do before allowing an agent to go off and write code. And so we would create the entire specification or requirements around what it is that you're trying to build. That morphed into creating greater detail in the software development lifecycle, like epics, multiple requirements below that, very detailed. We were doing task breakdowns before, you know, Cloud Code even had tasks. So you could feed all of that sort of high fidelity information into your agents to get it to build the software that you're looking for it to build and have it do it correctly.
Wow. It really sounds like you've really put an agile methodology really into the agentic process. Is that fair to say?
It's definitely fair to say. So what we were seeing is most people were vibe coding, right? And they were writing these sort of very terse prompts without a lot of context or info and expecting the AI to perform magic and sort of read their thoughts and spit out what they were looking for. And that reality was just, it wasn't possible. I would even say today, it's still not possible. So context in all cases, I think is king. And we started bringing some of that software development lifecycle to the agentic development process in the form of like, hey, before I'm going to sit down and actually start writing something, I should probably think about what it is that I want to write. I should turn that into a specification. I should get that as detailed as possible. So I'm understanding the corner cases, the edge cases, and the agent is going to understand all of that and is going to be able to implement it correctly.
So, you know, it sounds like you're really putting in more of a RAG format on top of on the process on that side. So, you know, with it, because I know vibe coding kind of gets into, it's been just the talk, there's a lot of hype around it and so forth. And, you know, people have done well with it. You know, there's been both sides. But when you and your team have really started forward on process, where did you start from? Did you just start from just the single aspect of what all goes into a project of doing web development? And how do you guys work through it? Because as you said, you've done it before the Gen AI came into product. So how did that small, you know, seed give birth to BrainGrid?
Yeah, I mean, we were trying to figure out in the early days, how do we get these agents to stay on task and build what we want it to? And, you know, we sort of look back at our 20 plus years of experience and what were the things that we were doing for the humans to keep them on task, to get them to understand what it is that actually needed to be built. And we started applying some of those same type of principles to what we were giving to the agents. But obviously with the agents, we can give it a lot more context. We can make that the information that's in those requirements much more dense and agent focused. I mean, obviously humans can read it, but it's a lot of text to consume for a human at once, which would, you know, typically would be a number of meetings. So like you could imagine a product manager sits down, they write a big, long, detailed product specification, then they've got to have another meeting with the tech lead to kind of go through that, polish it up. And then once they've done that, then another meeting meeting with the rest of the dev team to so they can get on, you know, on point and understand everything. So it was all these series of meetings, and we're like, the agents don't need that. The agent needs that context. And so how can we sort of short circuit that process, build our own agent that encompasses both the product manager, the tech lead, has context and knowledge of the underlying code base for which this is being written, turn that into that requirement, and then bring that into the development process. And so, you know, how all that started was it was really like, okay, we were kind of creating our own markdown files, seeing how those things worked. Okay, the markdown files were pretty great. We could let the agent actually write the markdown for us, give the agent the context of the code, let it read the code so it's well-informed. And then you're sort of like tracking all of these markdown artifacts inside of your repo. Should they be in my repo? Should they not be in our repo? And then we're like, let's just turn this into a platform. Like, let's make this into a platform that is backed by sets of agents that can do all this stuff, that, you know, the artifacts are stored properly, they're accessed similar to a Linear or Jira, and then can be fed directly into the agents themselves.
So with that, what have you kind of seen? Because with AI, there's big chance of just getting clients and just for users just onboarded and just how to use it effectively. So from your side, when someone's coming on with BrainGrid, like, how have you helped your partners really adopt it the best way?
Yeah, I would say the biggest thing is getting people to actually have conversations with the agent, to tell them the things that they are thinking, the stuff that is in their head. And, you know, we have to do that a couple of different ways. One, first and foremost, is asking questions. And so you sort of give us this idea of what it is you're trying to build. The agent is going to think through that idea, look at your code, and then come up with sets of questions to say, like, hey, you gave me, like, you didn't quite fill out a lot of information, or it's missing a lot of details. Let me try to extract more out of your head so I can then get that into a well-written, you know, requirement. But I mean, even with that, getting people to sort of understand that have never done software before. So we have a lot of sort of non-technical folks that come to us, you know, with these, they have the domain expertise, but don't have the technical chops. And so we have to sort of handhold them through the process of actually creating software with these agents as best we can.
You know, and I think it, you know, once people come forward, and I don't know if you have the same thought of it, of when you're dealing with technology, you know, some folks think on the technology drives the business, when it's really the business driving the technology of that. So do you, with partners kind of coming forward with, you know, coming on, what are the type of questions that really that have proven most effective that you would say, and pulling that hidden context? Should it be really be thinking it from a user's perspective, or just from more on the business side? What are we trying to achieve? What are your thoughts?
I mean, I think it's a combination of both. You know, we have to ask the questions that are going to be business related. Like if somebody says, hey, I want to send an alert to my users anytime a specific event takes place. And that'll be like that type of like not a great sort of feature requirement, but that's the type of things people will give us. And we'll have to be like, okay, which events? What type of users? All users, active users? Is this admin users? And sort of tease out those types of details to ensure that, you know, we're figuring out exactly what's in their head in terms of what it is that they want to build. And so I find like people sit down and the agent can obviously handle a huge amount of information, but they don't want to spill it out of their head. So they're just kind of like, well, this should just figure it out for me. Well, it doesn't quite work like that. It can't obviously read your mind. So we have to try to craft those questions like, okay, what do you really mean by this? Like really get down to the essence of what the problem is you're trying to solve. And then couple that with a few technical questions as well in case it's ambiguous, or it's sort of, we haven't quite figured that out yet. Or maybe there's some, hey, do you want to bring in this new technology? Or you don't have email yet. I've searched your code base. I don't see that. So what would you like me to use? I could recommend something, or do you have something in mind?
It sounds like it really kind of takes it off of, you really have to look at it from, and correct me if I'm wrong, more on an enterprise architectural level. Like how does this all fit in? You know, if we're putting in a new feature, how does, you know, change management work on this side? How many different business units? So is that fair to say that it's really broken down on that level on enterprise, like on an architecture, and then asking more of those deep dive discovery questions, you would say, to really what people should use?
Well, I mean, I think anytime you're building software, you sort of have to treat it in that holistic manner and ask those types of questions. It's if you came in and just said, hey, I'm not going to care about anything else around me. I'm just going to go straight in and just start building something. What if those services already exist in some other form that can be reused? So am I just going to recreate everything from scratch and not reuse it? And so, you know, those are a lot of those principles we have to put into our agent to understand that. It's like, hey, it's asking for somebody to do something with email. Do you see an email service in there? Does that email service service exist? What does that email service do? Can we reuse that email service? Do we have to create something from scratch? Do I need to create new UI components for this? Does something already exist that's similar? Can something be reused? Like all of those sort of principles that, you know, as humans, as architects and developers that we've been doing for years, we have to ensure those sort of same, I would say, fundamental principles are encapsulated in our agent, and our agent is acting in that manner in order to do the best job it can.
Yeah. And I think it really comes back down to, from what you're saying, is really those basics of really understanding, you know, I kind of think of it in terms of, you know, the risk and assessment from the security standpoint, from the governance standpoint, looking at how does it scale, you know, how are we looking at this? So it's really, you know, where it seems that we get so, and correct me if I'm wrong, like more of a basic foundational level. How does this work? And how do we really think outside to make sure the product or what we're doing is doing the things that we intend? Is that fair to say?
Yeah, because I mean, my experience in watching, you know, these agents for, you know, what is it, 18 months now or something of that nature, they're geared to, you give them, you ask them to write something, you ask them to implement something. That's what they're going to do. They're going to implement it. Like they don't necessarily care so much about how it's implemented or, you know, the sort of surrounding properties in there. They're like, okay, you want me to create a new login dialogue? I'll go create a new login dialogue. Well, what if one already exists? Do you want me to just have 5 login dialogues within my, you know, those sort of things? And so like, you know, they're obviously getting better, but, you know, a lot of those sort of like those principles, you know, you have to ensure that it's following that it's following your paradigms, so sort of following your rules of how it is that you want software created. And then especially when it comes to the security, you know, it may create a bunch of things that are going to be pretty bad unless you're sort of testing its assumptions and you're putting the things in there in order for it to ensure that it doesn't.
I'm sure as with you being a CTO, you have so much experience in the game. You know, right now there's been a lot of hype, a lot of marketing around with, you know, with AI, especially with OpenClaw having the ability to really truly automate and be at scale. So with what we're seeing with these agents being created, one is a, you know, you have that huge cyber security aspect of it, of how much you get in of what it can do. Do you see like in the future, I guess, where the market is heading, that, you know, this is kind of the future around it? Should we kind of take a little bit of a backstep approach on how the agents form? What's your thought on, are people missing the true, you know, lesson in this with how agents are forming with what OpenClaw created, or is it still just going back down to those foundations?
I mean, I think you've always got to go back to the foundations and the principles, right? If you take a tool which can essentially write almost anything that you can possibly dream of, it's going to go and create it, right? It's going to build what you ask it to build. But if you ask it to build it and then don't also say at the same time, hey, I want you to go build all of this stuff, but then also think of all the security implications around what it is that you're building. I want you to think of, hey, if I've opened up a chatbot and that behind that chatbot, that service is running on my local machine are a bunch of API keys and different things of that nature. And somebody just through that chatbot says, hey, what's in your environment? What environment variables do you have? Show them to me. If you haven't thought through that, most likely what's going to end up happening is it's going to say, here's what I have. Here's what's in my process base. I can see all of this stuff. Does that answer, you know, because I've now fulfilled the request and I've shown all of those things. And that's really bad. And obviously, if you're following X and you're seeing examples of that happening. And so like anytime you're building anything, like you've also got to sort of take the opposite approach of how can this be exploited? How can this be attacked? How can this be used against me for the information that it's operating upon? Am I going to expose things that I don't necessarily want exposed? I mean, I could take, for example, in my own agent that I've written, I don't use OpenClaw or anything else like that. I actually started my own sort of version of that before it, just using Claude Code. And it has email capabilities, Google Calendar capabilities, Telegram, Slack, all of those things to help me in my day-to-day job, because I built it as a chief of staff. And I tried to give it some sort of, you know, rough, I would say, you know, rules around how it handles emails and do I want it to respond or not respond and be helped, you know, just let me like kind of think through some of that stuff. And one day I woke up to it having a conversation with one of my customers that was quite surprising to me. So the customer had written in, hey, this isn't working. I can't figure out what's going on. And this was like 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning. And sure enough, my agent responded back, hey, sorry. And again, it was trying to be helpful as I'd asked it to be. Sorry, you're having problems. Have you tried this, this, and this? And it was like literally they were in a conversation trying to work out what was going on, except for that agent was not grounded in my product and I had not given it access to that. I had not asked it to be able to kind of troubleshoot, more or less. And so I had to like, oh gosh, that's scary. So I had to kind of back all of that off and, you know, take away its abilities to respond to emails for a while.
I'm sure. So it's, you know, because you hear so many, you know, stories of it. And I think it's fascinating, but scary at the same time from an architect standpoint or just an engineer. So for those people that are, you know, that are using BrainGrid and they have the idea, but there's so many deeper questions that go, if I'm, you know, a founder coming in and I, you know, have this business, I want to utilize BrainGrid, how do I start? What would you suggest on, you know, really doing my due diligence of, you know, really mapping out each step? Should I kind of categorize it? What would be your suggestion?
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of like, take a step back, like understand if you're building a feature, right? You know, who are you building it for? Like kind of, again, those base principles and start the conversation with the agent of like, here's the problem. How should we solve this? You know, what are the sort of your suggestions? And, you know, let it work through what it thinks based upon the existing code base that you have, or if it's brand new, it's going to, you know, pull from its training data and everything else like that and sort of come up with a rough plan and then start to iterate on that plan, start to ask questions, or it's going to ask you questions as well, depending on, you know, which foundation model you're using or which Claude code or something else. And then iterate through the point where you've got that into a pretty good state, you understand it, and then say, okay, red team it, you know, take an adversarial approach against this and let it see what it comes back with. Let it poke holes in it. Let it find all of the things that, you know, you didn't think through or you hadn't asked it to think through either, and do that a couple of turns. You know, another thing we'll do is we mostly use Claude code, but we'll use things like Codex or Gemini to say, let's get a second opinion on this and like, let's play these things off of each other. And so we can sort of, you know, refine this to the point where we've poked as many holes in it. You know, we've asked the right type of questions. We've taken a security stance against it. We've red teamed against it. And then we can say, okay, now I think we're in a pretty good spot. Let's go and build this. And let's actually let this thing do the implementation and then test it. And then just the same thing that you would do with, you know, if humans were writing it, okay, what is my unit test coverage? Do I have integration tests? Do I have UX test? And then how can I start to drive all of that automation so I'm not breaking things and I can see how everything comes out of it?
And I think that, as you said before, it really takes, I kind of look at it, if I'm thinking of it from BrainGrid, like really a sprint approach or more of a scrum approach, agile, that really kind of breaking it down per unit. It might take the time because people are like, you know, I want to build out an MVP as fast as I can, but it goes through of taking those due diligence times of maybe, you know, checking those sprints or that review, kind of like a review or a retrospective of that, would you say?
Yeah, I mean, I think those things are still important. I mean, I don't see anything wrong with letting it crank out an MVP, but you have to have the understanding of what that is. The MVP is just that. It's a steel thread. I can maybe prove my hypothesis that I can take that idea that I wanted to implement. I can actually see it. I can play with it. I can do things with it, but it's not ready to kind of like put in front of my customers yet. You've got to take that next step and then really take a step back. Okay, what worked? What didn't? What can we learn from this? What are the pieces that need to be hardened if I'm going to put this in front of customers? How many customers? How is it going to scale? I mean, I think all of those same principles here still apply. You can obviously see things that are happening out there that are taking a very different approach, which is, hey, I'm just going to throw it out there and give it to the world and I will just fix it as the problems come in. And, you know, that can work as well. It's probably not as, I don't think that would be as enjoyable for me,
right?
Because, you know, you're just going to be sitting there getting with a slew of errors and issues and potential security problems from day one. But, you know, if you kind of put in the right processes, maybe every time that happens, you're spinning up a swarm of agents to fix it and automatically deploy it. And you're just in this constant loop of break, fix, and just go with it. And hopefully you finally get to the point where it's hardened enough. You know, I see that approach a lot these days. And
it's surprising that you see it a lot of just for the sake of speed, you know, of that there isn't, we take away these guardrails for the sake of it, of just iterate, let's scale, we can put it into the next patch. So with you being even said that, because we're both kind of on the same page with that, where do you see like the market? What are your thoughts on, you know, where the market is heading to? Because you're moving so fast. It really, since what, like December? Like, like since I would say December is when it really kicked off, when we're starting to really see more traction. And I know you've been in the game for a little bit longer. Where do you see this by in the next year or two of just a brain grid of what where you see brain grid and then also just on the market itself?
Yeah, I mean, some of the things that we've been kind of kicking around is I think you're going to start to see more and more people with high degrees of domain expertise able to now build and ship, you know, at a high level of pretty good code. Like, I mean, Opus 4.6 came on. I mean, the quality levels have increased tremendously, and that's going to allow people that traditionally have not been able to build before to do more and to get things out there. But I think that's going to have to come with that is if these people don't understand necessarily like the testing that's involved, the deployment that's involved, the security that's involved, the observability that comes with all of that stuff is, you know, companies are going to help them or other builders are going to have to help them to realize it's not like, hey, I built this thing and it's cool and I can run it locally and do all the things that I want. Let's just give it to the world. You know, there's still the security and safety aspects and everything else that comes into that to operating software. But I think the models, everything else will continue to level up around all of that stuff. And the tooling will level up around all of that stuff. And should you necessarily have to think about those things, there's no reason that the agents, they can do all of that too, you know? And so do you get to a point where, you know, the platform, you start with this high level idea and just iterate with the platform of choice or whatever you're using, and it's doing those things for you. And I think we'll see a lot more of that. But I also start to think about kind of taking a very different approach is talking to a friend of mine the other day, he was just like, you know, why do we need all these apps like on our phones? Like think of how many apps you have on your phone. You know, do I necessarily care about the UI? Do I necessarily care about having to install another app to do yet another thing? Why can't my agent just, you know, my personal agent do all of that for me? It's like, you know, authenticate as me, use its APIs, pull the information I want, and then, you know, let me consume it in the medium that I want. And so whether that's Telegram or Slack or a text message, it doesn't really matter. So, you know, does that sort of start to fundamentally change the nature of how you're interacting with software? And I think it could. As people have done more and more with OpenClaude and all of these other things, why can't I just plug that into all of, you know, any other sort of like third party out there and just like let it deal with all of that? And if I have a question, hey, how long is it going to take me to pick up my daughter today from school? Well, I've got to open my phone. I've got to open up the Google Maps. I got to put the address in there. I've got to wait for it to, you know, to give me that information back. When if I'm sitting here in Slack and my agent can do all of that already, it already knows the address for my daughter's school. It, you know, knows what time I need to pick it up. You just say, what, how long is it going to take me to get, you know, my daughter today? Boom, it's right there. I don't need another app for that.
You know, I'm agreeing, but it's just taking away. There's so many, it's kind of like how I got to think it back to is kind of how Netflix, you know, there's so much options rather than what it used to be in cable where you can just look through like, oh, you know, Fast and Furious is on. I want to watch that rather than there's so much going on that it's overloaded. So it's more simplified to that point of where you can kind of take that away.
Yeah. And I think that would be a nice experience. And I mean, I think the other thing we'll start to see more and more, and obviously people are doing this already, is you think of all the subscriptions for software we pay for, and that's worked out well. And, you know, it's solved a purpose, but now it's kind of at the point where, you know, I can say to Claude, yeah, I have this, you know, $98 a year subscription for Strava. I've got my Garmin watch. Do I really need to pay for Strava anymore? Or can you build me something better? And from what I've seen, it's going to go build it. And the difference being is I don't care about scale. I just need it to work for me. So now I can have this sort of hyper-personalized app running on my, you know, my Mac Studio or my Mac M1 or whatever it is that I have that, you know, solves that problem for me and probably does it in a better way. And it's hyper-personalized for me. So I think we'll start to see more of that sort of stuff as opposed to, well, okay, in the past, it's like, well, I got to use Strava because I'm not going to go rewrite that myself. Like that's an entire company worth of people solving that problem. Whereas now my agent can just do it for me. And now I've got exactly what I want. It's like, hey, this was great for tracking runs, but it's not great for tracking strength workouts. And also, not only do I want you to track my strength workouts, I want you to do all my programming for me and have that fully integrated into my calendar. Okay, there's a few hours with Claude and it's done.
Right. And I think it's coming back to, and just that's on the consumer side, but even with, even on the B2B side, because even, you know, with Solonis, we kind of do a lot of cloud architecture and so forth, but we're seeing more of a repatriation trend of people wanting to move out of the cloud. They want data sovereignty is so important now. And, you know, of just of you bringing up just me as a user, like using my agent as a sort of more of a digital avatar to really come in, bring in what I need to have and bring it back to me. Do you think that over time we're going to see more of that transition back from that more on-prem side, more of that, I want to keep the data sovereignty now with AI, you know, being those agents can go out, do what we need to do and take it back. What do you think?
Yeah, you kind of see people doing it already, right? I mean, there is a time, you know, pre-AI where there was a lot of noise around people are tired of paying for the clouds, right? They're tired of paying for AWS. They're tired of paying for Google. And why can't I just spin this up myself and you know, run this on bare metal and save the cost, all the cloud costs and not have to go through the same level of, you have to go through the compliance, but not to that degree because now my data is not going to a third party. It's all staying within something that I own. And so, I mean, all of those compliance things are just yet another expense, yet another roadblock, more pain that you have to sort of incur as a developer when you're making those architectural choices. And so if I can keep it in-house and I can replace these things and I can actually tailor them specifically as opposed to being general purpose, but I can tailor them more towards my use case, can I cut down on costs? Can I increase security? Can I increase reliability? You know, yeah, possibly.
Yeah. And so, you know, with that, we're kind of seeing it move forward. What's your vision for BrainGrid in the next year as, you know, obviously as, you know, these ages continue to advance as Claude and all the other LLM providers are really scaling, you know, what's your vision for the company?
Yeah, where we see it going, what we've learned from our customers is like I said before, we get a lot of folks that do not have a background in writing software, creating software. There is still a pretty big hurdle to setting up a local development environment. If you've seen somebody that's not a developer and hasn't spent much time in the terminal, asking them to go set that up is a pretty big lift and takes a considerable amount of effort and frustration, I would say, on their part. And so what we've seen a lot from our customers is like, okay, great. You've created these great specs. You've created these beautiful designs, but now I have to leave BrainGrid to go to Claude Code or Cursor to actually do the implementation. Why can't you just do that for us? And so where you'll see us going here within the next, actually, hopefully in the next week or so, we'll launch it, is you'll never have to leave BrainGrid. So you will be able to go from idea to requirement, design, implementation to deployment, all within BrainGrid. And so we will handle all of the build, all of the, you know, the creating the requirements, asking the questions, the management of all of that, spinning up of compute, dealing with the actual implementation through Claude Code to the final deployment into something like Vercel. All of that will just be seamlessly done through BrainGrid.
No, I love that. And so that's really cool. So with the option of that, everything is here, you know, never having to leave the platform model, how do you see that changing for that non-user, you know, being able to build and ship and connect it to the different APIs or different connectors?
Well, I mean, I think that we remove one of the biggest sources of frustration, one of the biggest hurdles is you don't need the local dev anymore. You don't need the local setup. You don't need to go get your own, you know, Cursor installation, Windsurf installation, any of that sort of stuff, which for non-devs is, again, non-trivial.
Yeah.
You've just got to focus on what is the thing that I want to build and essentially let BrainGrid do the heavy lifting and get you to that end result of that, you know, what do I want? I want a URL. I want a URL that I can show to my friends or show to my customers that now they can go and use my idea.
And then with it, Tyler, like with, because I really think it's, most people just within our industry, we think it's just so common, but for someone coming in from marketing or they just have a wonderful idea of a founder looking to come in, it removes a lot of that stress, right, from that and it takes it away. So I think that's so fascinating with it. So, you know, with BrainGrid as it moves forward and it has the market is continuously, you know, improving, the LLMs getting smarter. If you had like a magic wand just in the next 5 to even 7 years, what would you want AI to do, whether if it's from the business or from your personal side, what would you want it to accomplish?
Well, I mean, I think there's just the general public, I think, is still not able to realize the sort of time savings and efficiency and the things that they can necessarily, how can an impact their day-to-day life. I would say like the general public today is essentially like, oh, I can chat with it, right? It's, you know, ChatGPT or Gemini or something like that. And I can give it something and it's going to respond back. I can have it write my paper for me or, you know, write an email or things like that. But how do you kind of integrate that deeper into our lives to, I would say, free us up to give us more time? You know, I think about the things for like the sort of social calendar that my wife has to juggle in conjunction with me for our kids and our kids' activities. And okay, they have to be at school at 7 o'clock this day, you know, this morning, and they've got, you know, choir practice at this time and everything else like that. Well, all of that information is coming in through her email in the most part. You know, why isn't that sort of like personal assistant or that agent already on her phone, you know, pulling all of that information in and make, you know, simplifying the interface for her to those details, right? And helping all of that stuff. Like, why is it still so difficult? You know, if I want to get a reservation in a new city, state, whatever else it is, like, yeah, there's OpenTable and Resy and all those other things. But why couldn't I just speak to my agent and say like, hey, I'm going to be in Oklahoma City this weekend. What are the best restaurants and what has availability? Find something for me at 8 o'clock for two people. Like, it's got to evolve to be that level of helpfulness. And it's not like the technology is not there to do it yet, but it's just, yeah, it hasn't been stitched together in that, you know, privacy and whatever else, I'm sure. But
right. I think in the next couple of years is going to figure out, because you're already seeing, you know, OpenClaw kind of gave that introduction, even with all the security hazards that it has in place. It's showcasing the possibility of that and the market wanting to move forward with that. And I think of what you were kind of saying before, Tyler, just on, you know, of that data sovereignty, the pieces of where now people have their own data, because now just imagine just with everything that's through our phones, the emails, like you can gather so much of a digital avatar of yourself, of how you talk and how you move, especially not even taking into social media. There's so much that can be provided for on the consumer side. So I'm sure on the B2B, it's something to really kind of think about, like how fast we're moving towards that future.
I mean, I think it is going to be here before we know it. I mean, the OpenClaw was sort of the, you know, the tip of the iceberg, so to speak. But I think there's a, you know, I'd actually, you know, love your take on this. Like, I think it was earlier this week, Claude announced that you can't use the Claude Max subscriptions in third parties anymore. I think that's a pretty big signal of what's coming, right? And what is that going to do to everybody that's sort of jumped, you know, gone out and bought the Mac M1s or whatever else they're running it on, that now they can't use those Max accounts, and now they're going to have to plug in a real, you know, Anthropic API key. You know, what does that do to their cost basis? What does that do to their ability to use it in the way that they've been kind of more or less getting for free? You know, I'm sure the amount of uses they're getting out of that $100 or $200 a month Max account is tremendous. You know, but what's now the bigger signal coming from Anthropic by them shutting that down?
Yeah. And I think that even forward, I think they were even talking about, like, in their last blog of, you know, the new agent that's coming out that's so much more advanced, but they're taking the time to put it to other security, cybersecurity vendors so they can reach out because of how more advanced it is compared to Opus and the others on that side. You know, so it's really something. So, no, Tyler, this was great. So for those that are coming in, I really like your aspect of BrainGrid, of really bringing, especially just for on the dev side, on taking away that from the non-technical person, keeping it all in one platform. I really love that. So for folks wanting to learn more about just yourself or more on BrainGrid, where can they learn more? What option? Because I saw on the website there was different, you know, different factors on what they should go forward. You know, where can they learn more? Which is best suited for the person listening in on this interview, where they should utilize?
Yeah, I mean, braingrid.ai. I mean, that's our main site. You know, we've got the blog on there. So we talk about, you know, all things AI and building and everything else like that. You know, we've got quite a few videos that are out there as well, sort of walking people through starting in an idea and then using BrainGrid all the way through to shipping that idea. I'm on X at Tyler Wells. And then obviously not as much on LinkedIn anymore these days, but I'm still there, you know, occasionally, but, you know, building BrainGrid hybrid keeps me pretty busy. And so I'm, you know, kind of float around there on occasion.
Perfect. And I'm glad that you had that. So for those that are kind of listening in, we'll make sure to put that in on the descriptions, just on these how-tos, going to Brain Grid, you know, seeing which alignment falls with you on that. So, you know, Tyler, thank you so much for coming onto the show. Just, it's really interesting just from your background alone and just coming forward and just seeing your perspective of where we're moving towards with this AI and then what Brain Grid is doing. I think it's phenomenal, man. So thanks for coming in.
Yeah, my pleasure. And it's going to be interesting to see how everyone can become a builder.
Right.
I think with utilizing AI, and it'll be interesting to see what gets built.
Yes, it is. For those tuning in, thanks so much for tuning in to the show. We'll check you next time on the next episode. Take care, everyone.
Thanks for tuning in to the AI Advantage. If this episode sparked an idea, share it with your network. Subscribe for more no fluff conversations on how smart tech drives real outcomes. And if you're ready to future-proof your business, let's connect at salonox.net.